Oh, hey there. Good morning, Nexus. Good to see you. Welcome to week 3 of 4 on Acts 15, the Jerusalem Council. One of the things I've been thinking, you know, is that anytime I try to talk about the controversy over circumcision in the New Testament, it's kind of like I can almost sense, even over screens here, I can almost sense people's eyes glazing over, because a controversy like that is just so foreign to us. It seems almost silly, right? Like, really? This was the big debate of the day? It can be hard, I think, for us to sort of properly get our heads into how controversial this was, and it's hard to contextualize for us. So what I want to try to do to start is try to illustrate how a symbol, which is what circumcision was, how a symbol, like, say, circumcision or a flag or something like that, can mean vastly different things to different people. So consider this. On Sunday, September 24th, 2017, early in the morning, President Trump is angrily tweeting out tweets, as he was wont to do, but he was tweeting this time about a recent phenomenon in sports: players taking a knee during the national anthem. Colin Kaepernick, of course, who started the whole phenomenon, he was called that morning some choice words by Donald Trump, and then he went on to encourage NFL owners to suspend or fire players who decided to take a knee. Now, the NFL's games operation manual actually says this: all players must be on the sideline for the national anthem, stand at attention, face the flag, hold helmets in their left hand, and refrain from talking. Now, where have I heard something like that before? Right, in the book of Daniel, when King Nebuchadnezzar has people bow down to his little shrine thing. But I digress. You see, failure for these players to follow this manual, it could result in consequences, fines, suspensions, forfeiture of draft choices. On this morning, the question was, would players be allowed to violate the rules regarding the national anthem? Now, a few hours later, it's 9:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and across the ocean at London's Wembley Stadium, the Baltimore Ravens and the Jacksonville Jaguars, they're the first teams to play on that Sunday. And sure enough, they take the field, both teams link arms, and they collectively take a knee during the playing of the Star Spangled Banner. More of the same kept happening throughout the day, right? With eventually that day, hundreds of players, hundreds of football players, coaches, staff, they took a knee during the playing of the national anthem. Now, I'm sure you heard of the controversy. For some, of course, this was seen as a very appropriate and needed form of protest. For others, though, the act, of course, was met with boos, even heckles in the stands, because this act was seen as disrespecting the flag. Now, I know it's possible to disrespect a person, but how do you disrespect a flag? I mean, a flag is, right, like my t-shirt, it's just a piece of fabric. Can you disrespect fabric? Now, of course, what we all know is that clearly a flag symbolizes an idea, and this was the controversy. The act was seen by some as disrespecting the idea behind the flag. The trouble, of course, with symbols and slogans and flags, though, is that the idea behind them, behind a flag, isn't exactly clear. Here's where the story gets really interesting for me. You see, this Sunday, September 24th, it wasn't just any Sunday. It also happened to be another symbolic day, a symbolic Sunday. It was the National Gold Star Mother's Day, which is essentially a day in the U.S. where they honor mothers who have lost their children in service to the U.S. military. And that day, watching these players take a knee on the field, one of the Gold Star mothers whose son had died serving in Afghanistan, watching this unfold, the flag, well, it meant to her something incredibly different than it did to those players. Watching the scene, she said this: "My heart kind of stopped and I lost my breath, because the flag that I see is the flag that draped my son's casket." Ooh, this is telling to me, and It speaks to me volumes about the nature of symbols. And in looking at a symbol, people can see very different things. When looking at the U.S. flag, black athletes might see oppression, brutality, police violence, or maybe at the very least, an idea or an ideal that is yet to reach them. But this mother, of course, what she sees looking at the flag is service, sacrifice, loss, and grief. One flag, two very different lenses. One flag, two very different meanings. And you see, these two competing visions of the U.S. flag, they kind of sum up for me what it is that's happening in the early church around this circumcision question. Why was this such a big deal? Well, there's two perspectives going on here. For certain Hebrew Christians who had grown up in the Jewish tradition, circumcision was a symbol of identity. It was their outward mark, you could say. It was their sign, their symbol, their flag. It was the way that they visibly stood apart from others. It was a symbol of their identity and relationship with God. And more than that, it was a symbol, you could say, of their history coming from Abraham. Of course, their 400 years in slavery in Egypt. Of course, a symbol of the period of the great temple and the great kings, but also a symbol of their exile into Babylon and even now living under the oppressive regime of Rome. Get rid of that symbol and you start to erase their identity. See, but beyond just being an outward symbol or sign, behind it were also 613 specific identity markers, 613 of them. The Torah contains 613 commandments that all Hebrew people did their best to obey and follow. To be circumcised was to be a Torah person. And so the question for the early church was, what do people need to do to become Jesus path people? And the obvious answer for many was, well, they need to be circumcised. They need to become Torah people. But then Paul shows up and throws all of it out. You know, when I speak here at Nexus about our practice of barrier-free belonging, it's very much rooted in what I see Paul doing here, because what Paul does is he looks at this question, how can people become Jesus people? And all that he sees is 613 barriers to belonging. And what he eventually does is he narrows it down to two. 613 barriers down to two. Love God, love neighbor. And so what you have are two very different ways of seeing the symbol of circumcision. For Hebrew Christians, it was like, this is what gives us our identity. Throw that out and you erase who we are as a people. You erase our way of life. But Paul sees it differently, where they saw identity. What Paul saw was obstacles and barriers. But this question about circumcision, it never goes away. And Paul finds himself dealing with this question again and again and again. And in one particular instance, I love this. Paul, at the church in Galatia, word comes to him that some people, after Paul's already been there, have come to the church in Galatia that Paul founded, and they're telling the people there, you need to be circumcised and you need to follow the 613 commandments. Paul, he's livid. This is what he says to the Gentile Christians in Galatia. It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm then and do not let yourselves be burdened again by a yoke of slavery. Mark my words, I, Paul, tell you that if you let yourselves be circumcised, Christ will be of no value to you at all. Again, I declare to every man who lets himself be circumcised that he is obligated to obey the whole law. Now, this is so interesting to me, and I think it speaks again to the nature of symbols. You take on this one thing, but what you don't realize is that you're on the hook for all of it. Take on this one symbol and suddenly there's 613 other things behind it that suddenly you have to adhere to. This isn't just about a symbol. It's about everything else behind it. Don't do it. Don't do it, Paul says. He continues this way. For in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor a foreskin has any value. The only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. Notice again how he boils it down there. What the Jesus path comes down to is trusting Jesus, following Jesus, expressing that trust through love. But later on in the letter, you can hear his frustration bubbling. It's almost like one of those emails that you send out, and the moment you hit send, you're like, I don't know if I should have said that. But Paul's frustrated here, and he goes on to address the proponents of circumcision this way. As for those agitators, I wish they would go the whole way and emasculate themselves. Now, come on, that's funny. I don't care who you are. He's like, these people are so obsessed with taking skin off penises. Why don't they just go the whole way and take the whole thing off? But again, he dials it back eventually and he sums up this way. You, my brothers and sisters, were called to be free. Do not use your freedom, of course, to indulge the flesh. Rather, serve one another humbly in love, for the entire law is fulfilled in keeping this one command, love your neighbor as yourself. Paul is performing this extraordinary act of removing barriers, 613 of them. Well, plus two, there's two left at the end of the day. But Paul's all about removing barriers to following Jesus. I mean, think about this. For Gentile Christians who want to follow Jesus and his path, there's two competing visions in front of them for how that can happen. One, follow Jesus by being circumcised and then having to follow 613 commandments, or follow Jesus and commit to loving one another. That's it. You know, some people have often said, how did Paul show up in the scene and become such a big figure in the New Testament? I mean, is it any wonder why? I mean, Paul's gospel took the world by storm, and he became the predominant voice within the early church for a reason, because for Paul, it came down to two things: love God, love your neighbor. Which version would you want to follow? Now, of course, the challenge with something like this is it can end up becoming a bit too kumbaya, right? And so while Paul doesn't have any symbols or rules for people to follow, the early church did have two practices. Both of them, of course, were instituted by Jesus, and these practices were meant to sort of be that place where the rubber hits the road, become a sort of litmus test for churches. And the practices are these: eating together and washing one another's feet. I want to unpack these for us. First, let's talk about eating together. You'll remember from last week, right, that Willie Jennings says that sharing food together is the most intimate reality of communal existence. And so the practice for early Christians was kind of, I would say this, it was kind of a combination of how we do Eucharist communion, what you would see in various churches around how that is celebrated, embedded inside something like a potluck. You know, I'll say this, I think that the church, much grace to them, but the church that I grew up in, I believe, did a lot of things wrong, or certainly not how I would do them. But if there's one thing that church got right, I think it was potlucks. These were not just like, you know, you and your buddies getting together kind of potluck, like hundreds of people in a huge gym potluck, like a mosaic of food, just food everywhere. And it was just so delightful. But one of the things I learned, of course, is that the potluck, there's a hierarchy of food. Now, I don't know if it remains the same today as it was back then, but there was sort of categories. Now, I don't know about you. I would love to hear what you guys think is the best potluck food, or what you would bring if we, imagine that. Imagine we could have a potluck. Wouldn't that be great someday? What would you bring? But growing up in the church I did, there was a hierarchy, right? Like there was this sort of standard line. You show up with lasagna or chili. That's pretty standard. That's great. And you need a lot of those for a potluck. At the very low end, Jell-O fruit salad. Does anybody do that anymore? I remember seeing those at potlucks like, oh my God, who does that? But of course, then you got your fan favorite, which is crock pot meatballs. Like you see a crock pot coming in, you're like, hello, yes, I got to hit that up. Now, I don't know if this would stay the same, but I remember growing up, there's this one guy who would bring in a bucket of KFC and whoo, that was a hot ticket item. Like he would slam it down and if you weren't on that in the first 5 minutes, it was gone. I would still like to think, you know, we're a little more hoity-toity with our food these days, but I'm almost convinced that if I brought a bucket of KFC to a potluck today, I still think it's gone pretty quickly. Who knows? But then, of course, you've got these delightful, elaborate casseroles all over the place, which are fantastic. But I have to say, in my own personal opinion, if there's one dish, one food that takes the cake at the potluck, the creme de la creme, it is the deviled egg. Oh boy, I made a batch up just for the sermon because I was so excited thinking about deviled eggs. But think about the deviled egg. Here's why I love it, because it's a metaphor for everything about the church. First of all, it's delicious. No one can deny that. It's just, well, maybe you can. I don't know. Maybe you don't like it, but it is just so delicious. But it's also a little risky. And that to me is kind of like the thing about church. Delicious, but risky. And that's the thing. Whenever you approach at a potluck, you see the deviled eggs, you're like, oh geez, when were those made? Like, how old is that mayo? Or good night. If you're at a summer picnic, sun beating down, and you come across deviled eggs, it's like, oh boy, who knows? That could be trouble. But to me, it is just the perfect thrill, delightful in the mouth. And it's also, in my mind, the perfect sample size. See, you take a big spoonful of a casserole, you don't like it, uh-oh, now you're committed. The deviled egg, it's a one-bite delicacy. I brought up two. I'm going to have the other one while I'm here. Yeah. I know we're separated across the screen, but I'm feeling all self-conscious now. I don't know how, if I have something in my teeth, and I almost feel like I gotta brush my teeth so I don't have deviled egg breath. I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have eaten those. Anyway, I'm gonna brush my teeth. I'll be right back. I'm back. Where was I? The deviled egg. Delicious. It's my pick for the potluck. Next time we have a potluck, may it be soon, I'm bringing the deviled eggs. I'd like to know what you're going to bring. It's going to be a dandy. Potlucks, though. See, I mean, here's the key to me. What I love about the potluck and how this sort of ties in with how the New Testament church sort of navigated life together is that there's two elements to it that I absolutely love. The first is that everybody brings something, right? To me, the potluck is this radically egalitarian act, this practice, because what it does is it reminds you that every single person in a community has something to offer to a community. And, you know, sometimes it's like you're blessed when that person in the community brings that elaborate, beautiful casserole. It tastes like heaven, right? But you're also blessed by the person who didn't have time and just shows up with a bucket of KFC. It doesn't matter. Everybody can bring something to the table and we all benefit from it. But second, what I love about this idea of this potluck where everyone's bringing food and how it's sort of encompassed by this holy act of the Lord's Supper where we remember Jesus' death. What I love about it is this idea that everyone has to receive something as well. Everybody has something to give, but everyone has to receive. You know, I think for a lot of us, bringing something to the table in community is often the easy part. We don't mind helping, serving, giving. The tougher part, I think, for so many of us is being willing to receive. And, you know, this was so driven home to me on these potlucks growing up. I don't know how else to describe it. I want to be as kind as I can. But there was a woman in our church growing up who unfortunately had this ailment, terrible ailment, where there were scars and like boils and just open wounds over her entire body. It just, truthfully, it didn't look great. And for all of us kids, it was like, oh, there was something physical going on there where it was so unsightly that you wanted to keep your distance. And yet every potluck, there she was serving her lasagna. And I remember I would always try to skip her, but my parents, I don't know if they knew at the time what they were doing, but if it was just a polite thing, but for them it was like, no, you take part of her lasagna. You receive even from those that you'd rather keep your distance from. You know, at the time I thought it was a politeness thing, right? But in hindsight, I think there's something deeper there. In community, we're always going to find ourselves around a table with those that we'd rather keep our distance from. And sort of the meaning of the potluck is that everyone has something to give, sure, but everyone has to receive. Everyone receives, even from those we'd rather be distant from. So this is the vision. And you know, it's interesting, in the book of Corinthians, we get instructions on how this is done, but we get it via the negative, because you see the church in the Corinth, we get a glimpse of them, and they're just a community that is just messing this up. They've made a complete mockery of this entire sort of vision of eating together, this communal life together. And Paul, again, is having none of it. It's amazing to me how often Paul seems to get upset in his letters, but you'll find out why here in a moment. Listen in on the gong show going on in Corinth. In the following directives, I have no praise for you, for your meetings do more harm than good. When you come together, it's not the Lord's supper you eat, for when you're eating, some of you go ahead with your own private suppers. As a result, one person remains hungry and another gets drunk. Don't you have homes to eat and drink in? Or do you despise the church of God by humiliating those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you? Certainly not in this matter. So then, whoever eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of sinning against the body and blood of the Lord. Everyone ought to examine themselves before they eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For those who eat and drink without discerning the body of Christ eat and drink judgment on themselves. So then, my brothers, my sisters, when you gather to eat, you should all eat together. Anyone who's hungry should eat something at home, so that when you meet together, it may not result in judgment. Now, from what we can tell, here's what's going on here. When this church met, they would say, make a plan like, hey, we're going to do this potluck Lord's Supper thing, say at 6 p.m. after those who had to work, of course, got off work. And of course, this is a slave economy. So this has to take place, remember, whenever the slaves who are a part of the church, when they can get away from their masters and come and be with the community. And so they've got to make a time to meet. But then it would seem what was happening is this: the rich and powerful in the church were like, whatever ancient texting was, like, hey, I know we're eating and gathering at 6, but why don't we get together ahead of time? And so that's exactly what would happen. And the rich, the powerful, the masters of the day, those who could afford to not be working and have spare time on their hands, they were arriving before everyone else, and they would start drinking and eating. By the time others showed up, the food was gone, the wine was gone, they're drunk. And so now you have these people getting off work, these slaves getting permission to come and feast together, and they show up and there's nothing there for them. And Paul is like, what are you doing? Do you despise the church so much that you can't see that you're humiliating these people? And so we have to remember, eating together for the early church, it was not in any way like you and I as friends, you know, a group of, say, 5 or 6 friends getting together doing a potluck. No, 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 no. This is way more radical than that. It was a meal that crossed every social boundary of the day. It was a radical act of subversion to have masters and their slaves eating at the same table, men and women, Jew and Gentile eating around a table together. It was unheard of. And it was called a love feast for a reason. And the love feast was A, communal practice of belonging, B, a communal practice of removing barriers, and C, a communal practice of learning to give to and receive from the very people we are often at odds with. This is how a Jesus Path community practices barrier-free belonging. This is how Jesus Path communities, how they embody the command to love God and love neighbor. you know, the second practice that the church had, and it's one that very few, if any, churches practice today because we don't almost have an equivalent. But the second one was this, washing each other's feet. In those days, it made sense. No cars, you were walking a lot, your feet were sweaty, dirty. When you showed up at a guest house, the lowest person, whoever was lowest in the hierarchy, would wash the feet of the guests. And so again, in an upending of hierarchy, of course, the Christians, they decide they're going to do this as an act of, again, removing barriers, or removing those hierarchy lines. And it comes, of course, from Jesus in John 13. Jesus got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. "Do you understand what I've done for you?" he asked them. "You see, you call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. But now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you should also wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you." Now, this gesture of washing someone's feet has been taught about at length, right, of course, about humility, and it is, of course, about that, but it's also very much about leveling playing grounds, and it starts with Jesus, who is highest on the hierarchy, stooping down and washing the feet of those below him, and it becomes this radical act. It becomes this act where those with more power stoop and serve those with less. What it required, of course, for them, it required having, I would say, a heart that was big enough to swallow a whole lot of pride. And I love the way Ronald Rollheiser captures the essence of this practice. He says this: "Jesus is inviting us to have the strength to bend down in understanding and wash the feet of those whom, for all kinds of reasons, we would rather not have anything to do with. It is akin to having pro-life and pro-choice, strident conservatives and strident liberals, fundamentalists and atheists wash each other's feet. Normally, we don't have the strength to do that. There is too much pride and desire for righteousness at stake." It would seem that what so ails this world, what ails myself, is, and churches, is that we simply today can't swallow our pride enough. We can't let go of our need to be pure, our purity culture. We can't let go of our need to be right. We can't let go of that enough to simply bend down and try to understand, serve those people we would rather have nothing to do with. And it was these practices, not symbols, not faith statements, not laws. It was these practices that managed to carry the early church forward despite bitter divisions, sharp disputes. You know, this fall has been, fall 2021, it's been on my mind a lot lately because, you know, should things go relatively well, it would seem to me that it's most likely the fall before we can return to any kind of semblance of normal. And I think the great temptation for all of us, be it individuals or communities, will be to rush right back to doing things the way we've done them, right? And there's a part of me even now thinking, you know, it's going to be a real lost opportunity if that's what we do without doing some learning and thinking from this time in exile, you could say. I think there's an opportunity for us as individuals, but also very much as a community, to think about what do we want to return to? Some things, of course, can't wait to get back to, but it's like we've got this one opportunity to sort of think through, what do we need to change? What do we need to reprioritize as a community? And, you know, as I've thought about personally for me, I think the biggest thing that I've missed from being apart from one another throughout this is things like Soup Sunday, Warren and Jenny's end of year celebration, pool party potlucks out at the Benjamins. It's things like that. And I think there's a reason for that because, again, as Jennings says, sharing of food is the most intimate of communal realities, and practices like that are truly, I think, our best shot at coming to understand one another and learning to love one another across whatever differences or divides we have. And my hope is that come this fall, should we be able to kind of go back to normal, whenever that is, that we would take the opportunity to pause, slow down, and build these kind of practices way more intentionally into the life of our community, because they are, I believe, where the real magic happens. You know, I wanted, of course, because we're talking about communion, to do Eucharist communion this morning. The wine, the bread, the substitutes. I got a Triscuit and some wine here for this morning. And there's such an oddity about doing this online. It feels neuter to me. But to me, it's still, even though I'm here alone, a bit of a reminder that while we wait, there's a promise of something more. And so as Paul says, we stop to remember the body of Christ broken for us, the blood of Christ shed for us. This is the path we've chosen to follow. Jesus is the one we're following. And this path of love is made possible through his death. And so we pause to remember. And so I hope you have your wine and your bread, your substitutes with you as we do this. And so for now, the body of Christ broken for you, the blood of Christ shed for you. For now, for this week, go in peace.